Okay, it's Sunday night, and this is the TechNet in New York. New York City. That's where this, that's the area that this TechNet originates from. I'm actually on Long Island, Huntington, Long Island. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey, and this is going to be TechNet number 1527 of the series of TechNets that began way back in September of 1982. That's 32 years ago. So, apparently the people who gather here must be offering something that somebody values, otherwise it wouldn't have lasted this long. When it first began way back in 1982, N2FDJ and IHIP thought that we'd answer people's questions. It would go on for a month or so. Once all the questions are answered, we dry up and go away. Didn't turn out that way. People gather because they've got a curiosity and interest about radio, wireless equipment. They want to know how it works, how to make it work better. Hams are extremely good at teaching each other what they've learned. And by their tinkering, they learn things that are not necessarily in the books. You want a good antenna engineer, choose one that's a ham radio operator that's been tinkering with antennas for some period of time in his backyard or maybe at his place of business. The schools do not really turn out antenna engineers. I'm almost convinced they don't even turn out radio transmitter designers or receiver designers. They give you some of the information that if you do a whole lot of work on your own, you can develop that skill, but you don't walk out of the school with that skill. It's something that takes a significant period of time to gather by way of the hams talking to each other as to what they've discovered. I tried the so-and-so antenna. I tried the such-and-such feed line and somebody else's transmitter. And this worked and this didn't work. And so by using the equipment, you'll notice that when a ham makes contact with somebody new, the first thing to do after passing the name and the call letters and the location, the first real piece of information that's transmitted is what transmitter you're using, what receiver you're using, what antenna you're using, how high up is it, what did you do before that, and so on. That's the kind of information that real experience, real tinkering experience, and there's a tremendous amount of value in tinkering. As you guys have heard me say from time to time, the names that go on my patents for antennas are with reference to tinkering, not with reference to antenna modeling. The computer modeling programs would not have found the antennas that I've put my name on for a repeater.
Time out.
Me and Mark Duran are the two guys who get together and have did quite a bit of those patents that I've been talking about. The TechNet has a very loose schedule from 8 o'clock to 9. We do a general question and answer. At 9 o'clock, John, KC2WGB, opens the mailbag for those who haven't yet got the ham license or the right equipment so they can talk to us directly. The TechNet is a live question and answer thing, and for the most part, we are not volunteering. Free, written consulting service. It's not what we volunteered for. Once in a blue moon, John or I or Paul or Hal will feel sorry for somebody and give them some written information, but that's not what we're promising. The majority of what's promising is a live give and take on the air. Yep. So after we go through a few of the mailbag general questions, in other words, John chooses questions that he thinks have an interest for more than just one person. Occasionally, of the hundreds of emails he'll get some weeks, occasionally it's some college kid submitting his homework questions for the TechNet. That's not quite fair. That's not quite what we're volunteering for. That's followed by Paul, WS2N, our space expert. And NASA's doing some darn good things these days, as well as the space agencies in other places around the United States, around the world. Along the way, Hal, K60PZ, he's got a lot of experience in a lot of different kinds of radios. He gives us what he claims to be is the more brief answer. And so the mixture my verbose answers and John's and Hal's brief answer. By the time you plow through all of that, and if the information is a little bit too complicated and you don't understand it the first time, you can always go to the website and play it back multiple times. Play back the recording. The last 7 or 8 years of TechNet are all recorded at a website by John number one, correction, here we go. Mike number one. And that is the TechNet amateurradio.tangovictor. Go to www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Choose the right year, the right month, the right week. And up there in 1 hour reels, and you can hear the last 7 or 8 years worth of TechNets. Mic number two is the other TechNet, the other very interesting website, which has the address of limontechnet.com. And there you'll see other written pieces of information and photographs and graphs and whatever, and explanations of how to get ideal impedance match to any dipole, whether the dipole is part of a Yagi antenna or any other kind of antenna, or it's all by itself, that kind of information. Alrighty, at this time we're about to take check-ins. Let me drop. A person checks in by giving that crowd, Dick, John, Paul, and Hal, you give this crowd the your call letters, your name, and the word yes. That means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need that sign in just to say that you're listening. Way back in the beginning, we used to have long lists of people saying that they're listening, and that's not required. After 32 years, we believe somebody is listening. That doesn't have to be proven to us anymore. So, hopefully there's people out there with some real questions, and there are some tech nets that are kind of boring and some that are very interesting. It isn't because John, Dick, Paul, and Hal had a sudden rush of brains to the head. What's really going on is the good tech nets are the ones where you guys ask some good questions, and the boring ones are where you guys ask questions that are not quite as interesting. Although be careful with that one. Sometimes a boring sounding question represents a piece of information the guy would really like to know what's going on, so that he can understand his equipment and troubleshoot some particular problem he's having. So maybe from a certain point of view, maybe there are no boring technets. Maybe it's just those that are more exciting than others. There are times when we abandon the schedule. Let me drop this. Occasionally this crowd gets real enthusiastic, hot and heavy on some particular subject, in which case we just throw the schedule out the window and go with the flow, if you know what I mean. So occasionally you hear that. So if you're looking for a net that is highly regimented, controlled, and very well organized, you're at the wrong place. That's not us. We make an attempt at it. So give me your call letters and name and the word yes if you have a question or a comment at this time. Typical sign in might sound like this, VE3ZTZ, Scott, and yes. He's one of the people who have signed in for a few times. Where do you take your check-in right now? KQRIW listening.
This is VE3JIW Toronto. Yes, I do have a question. VE3 Juliet India Whiskey Toronto, and I do have a question.
Very well. And that was a perfect sign-in, except Jim didn't tell us his name, but lucky for me, I know Jim. Okay, we got Jim from the Golden Horseshoe, area of Toronto, Canada. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
November 23, Juliet, November, after Paul. By the way, did you see the next new toy?
I think I did see the second toy. The first one was the dual scintillation counter, and I think I did see the next one. But, okay. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
DC2WGB with a question.
And that guy didn't give us his name. That mystery voice. good, John. All right, we got John. We got Jim and John. One more. And by the way, there was a significant flea market today held by Limock in Levittown. And so a little bit later on, I'd like you guys to tell us what it was like for you. In other words, did you see some good buys? Tell us the one that got away. And what did you sell? What did you buy? What did you see? How crowded was it? Did you enjoy it? Any suggestions for how it could be done differently? So we'll be asking that question a little bit later. One more call. Anyone with any question or a comment, give me a call that is a name right now. Okay, that was Paul. And for reasons I don't quite understand, your voice jumped out a little bit there that time, Paul. One last call. Anyone else with a check-in, give me your call that is a name.
Hey, Julie J., did you ever find that email?
Give me a hint. When I find the email, what's the subject matter, Eric?
It was a PDF, actually a PDF from Bird, about using Bird wattmeters and how to figure out SWR.
I sure did find that. Rather well written. Of a similar nature. And by the way, the slug on a Bird wattmeter really is a directional coupler. And one of the articles that you'll find at limogtechnet.com is an article by K2RIW using directional couplers for visual and power measurement. You take the combination of that article that I wrote, the article that was written by Bird that Eric is telling us about, very nicely done article, and you know, at the end of that, you'll know almost everything you want to know about measuring power and measuring standing wave ratio. Standing wave ratio really is the echo of your antenna. When you're sending that transmitting signal down that feed line, if the antenna was perfectly matched to the end of your feed line, the signal goes down there once, and all of it gets radiated into space, and none of it comes back. And if there's any impedance mismatch of your antenna, some of that energy reflects back. Call it echo if you like. Call it reflected power ratio. Call it voltage reflected power ratio. Voltage standing wave ratio. It's got lots of names. And so it's one of the areas that quite a few amateurs have a good deal of trouble with. A good number of electronic engineers in the RF world have trouble with that subject. When it comes to super low standing wave ratio required to make sure you don't get triple transit and echoes and ghosts on a television broadcast hardware antenna, I'll bet you've been down that road quite a bit. And I bet there are times that you've had discussions with people as to how it really works. Is that true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LAW?
K2LAW, KE2EJ. Well, in the analog days, if you had any real significant SWR, which is more than like, I think it was 1 to 1.08 or 09, somewhere in that neighborhood, you start to create ghosts that you're transmitting because the time delay of going back and forth as it bounces back and forth actually creates a little bit of a time shift at the edge of the signal, and you actually wind up making a ghost. In the digital world, it's a different problem, and it's just as bad, but the interesting thing about that is where you sample that signal as you're monitoring it and sending it feedback to the device that's actually creating it, it compensates for all that. It's very strange. K2IW, KE2J.
Bravo 2 Hotel, King Bravo 2 Hotel, have a loop.
I bet as you get echoes in a digital television system transmitter, it probably starts interfering with the bit error rate. You start getting inter-symbol distortion, and that combined with the multipath that occurs
between the transmitter and the receiver that might be picking number 20 miles away, the customer, so to speak, your client, your television receiving person. My guess is that any echoes within the transmitting system aggravates that, resulting into symbol distortion that the final receiver's demodulator sees, and as such, the 1.08 standing wave ratio you're talking about that's desirable, I'm guessing that represents something in the vicinity of 25 or 30 decibels of reflection coefficient from your own antenna. Is that approximately what's required for good transmission, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2LIW, K2J, that's about right. Actually, the way some of these ABS-B encoders require a sample, some people take the sample right at the output of the transmitter, and it looks at the data coming back and will actually shift things in time to compensate for the reflection coefficients that have been created by the reflection itself coming back. So I can't explain exactly the process because it's sort of complicated. It's the way you generate the ABS-B in itself, and the way the coding is applied to it and to create the symbols is a whole process. But it's really all math, and it looks at what's coming back and says, I basically have to change my table to put a least bit of energy at this particular period of time, more energy at that particular period of time. So, in essence, you are compensating for the fact that you have a reflection there.
I'm going to pick some numbers here to see how this all works, Eric. Let's assume that your transmitting tower at your broadcast station was 300 feet high. Let's assume that you're feeding it with airline coaxial cable, which has a velocity factor probably something like 95%. So 300 feet of airline between the transmitter and the transmitting antenna represents something in the vicinity of 300 nanoseconds of delay one way from transmitter to the antenna. By the way, the speed of light is very close to 1 nanosecond per foot. So 300 feet, 300 nanoseconds on the way up. The antenna has some standing wave ratio, so therefore some signal gets reflected. Another 300 nanoseconds coming back down, therefore it comes back to the transmitter 600 nanoseconds late. That echo off the transmitter gets re-reflected forward. That's the triple transit, a total of 900 nanoseconds in my example. Let me round that off to 1 millisecond. Correction, 1 microsecond. So 1 microsecond of delay on the digital data being transmitted, the direct signal, the strong one, and the triple transit, which is, well, let's say, 30 dB weaker. My guess is when that is transmitted, that 1 microsecond of delay on all the digital pulses, that makes things a little bit more difficult for the receiver demodulator at the customer's house. Is that approximately true, Eric? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
No, that's not approximately true. It's almost exactly true. I mean, if you can consider that a symbol, and let's just round it off and make it 10 nanoseconds. 10 nanoseconds divided by a microsecond is a lot of distance. So, that makes it very hard for the receiver, but you are not transmitting the same amplitude of the reflected signal. So, the equalizers that will have a plenty hard time with it, but they'll manage. But there is a point of no return. There is a limit to how much reflected signal you can have back and be emitted from the antenna and withstand the fact that it looks like another signal in a different slot in time. So once the receiver decodes the primary signal and lost to it, the reflected signal becomes less of an issue. Because don't forget that in the ABS-B, during shift, they're actually sending random numbers to make when you look at it on a spectrum analyzer, it looks like noise that's 6 megahertz wide. So timing's important, but again, there's a limit to how much reflection you can actually deal with, and a receiver that you put right next to the transmitter is not going to receive it anymore. K2RW, K2J.
I have the impression, Eric, that you have the enthusiasm, the curiosity, the desire to understand what's going on. You've dug pretty deeply into proper operation of your ATSC, your advanced television, well, your modern digital television transmission system. And so you're carefully tuning it, particularly the antenna, the low standing wave ratio. Here's my question. I am guessing that some of the broadcast transmitters, some of the broadcast stations out there, the people running the station only have partial understanding, haven't had the curiosity to dig deeply into it. Some of those systems could be operating with a significant amount of internal echo. So I wonder if you heard anyone doing an assessment. Has anyone ever gone around with the right kind of equipment where you can measure what's really being radiated? And are there broadcast stations out there somewhere in the United States which have got enough echo to be troublesome? KE2EJ, K2LIW.
Let me give you a short answer to a long discussion. Let's just break this down into a couple of different areas. You've got full power TV stations. You've got something called Class A TV stations. You have low power TV stations. All right, let's just talk about the full-power TV stations, generally in which even the chief engineers, what they will do is they will contract with a transmitter manufacturer and an antenna systems manufacturer, and they will, in essence, do the installation. So when that's put together and it's done right, you wind up with these, at the channel that you're interested in, of course, over the 6 megahertz that they're operating, you wind up with stuff that hams would be jealous of. I mean, all along the coax now, you know, you're talking 3-inch, 6-inch, 8-inch coax to a lot of this stuff. At various different points where there's elbows and things like that, there's little tuning devices which really allow you to cheat, so to speak. But as far as the big guys go, they don't get into trouble until something breaks. As we get into the Class A stations, those are usually done by a smaller contractor. It's not like getting it from a big-name transmitter manufacturer, because now we're talking about stuff that's cheaper. Low-power TV stations have the stations on the air that don't know. They think they're on the air, but they're not really. K2RW, K2J.
You've just gotten into an extremely interesting area, Eric. In the case of a waveguide-fed phased array antenna, slot phased array antenna, when you look at it from the front view, it looks like a flat plate with maybe 15, 30, 100, 200 slots in it, all fed by a waveguide assembly behind a phasing harness is what it's usually called. And there are times when a very smart antenna engineer trying to get the last little bit of performance out of the antenna does something called dent tuning. He literally is putting dents in very specific locations on a piece of waveguide in order to correct certain characteristics of the antenna. The guys on 10 gigahertz do something like this also, where you've got elbows and other things that in your waveguide, which it has to be there for mechanical reasons in order to get around the edge of the dish to get the signal from the transmitter to the feed on. Let me drop.
So they actually do that kind of tuning on UHF antennas, the collection of beds.
That doesn't surprise me. But if this is the best of all worlds, you'd have one very straight piece of coax, one very straight piece of waveguide that goes from the transmitter to the antenna. That's not the real world. You need elbows to go around corners, to get around various objects in the way, to go in and out of filters, in and out of equalizers. So there's going to be individual devices in the transmission line system that have perturbations to them. In other words, that signal flowing down the cable will not see a pure 50 ohms at every inch of the cable. If you're smart enough to know where the kinks in the cable are, standing wave ratio-wise, and you put the right kind of tuning devices, sometimes it's nothing more than a tuning screw that penetrates from the outer conductor toward the center conductor of a coax cable. Sometimes it's nothing more than a screw that penetrates into a piece of waveguide. But right at the devices that are doing the perturbation, there are ways of doing compensation by adding these extra tuning devices right at that location, and you stop it even before it gets going. You get a little hint about that when you read the article in TechNetLimoc.com that was written by K2LIW on using directional couplers for standing wave ratio measurement and power measurement. There's a way in there that the end of that article describes. Let me drop it. The article describes how you can take a directional coupler that has only mediocre performance concerning directivity. If this is the best of all worlds, your directional coupler will listen to the signal going forward, reject the signal coming back, and that rejection will be 50 decibels. Oh, that's an instrumentation grade directional coupler. An extremely good directional coupler would have 30 dB of coupling. A mediocre one will have 20 dB of coupling. There are ways that you can add a device right after the directional coupler that you can take your mediocre or even worse directional coupler and make it ideal. If you're smart enough, as long as you do it in the right locations, you can have all kinds of perturbations at your connectors, elbows, and bends and everything else in your transmission line system. And you can make it nearly ideal using what looks like gimmicking. And I think that's some of what you're describing here, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2RW, K2EJ. Well, what you think of in terms of waveguide, we also do in coax. Yeah, remember, the coax that we're talking about is 8 inches in diameter, the center conductor is an inch and a half or 2 inches in diameter. There's all this airspace, you know, it's got all these little Teflon legs in it to keep it uniform. You just got to imagine the amount of time that the guy spends with a really hot shot, loading towards the Spectrum Network Analyzer, and rigorous, because don't forget, these things are bolted. As when they install a system, and as they tune it, sometimes they have to take a section out and make it a little shorter, add a tuning adapter to it, and can move on. So it's a very mechanical process, and that happens all the way up the tower, which usually they do it at the end of the vertical run, make it easier on them, so that way you don't have people climbing up the tower segment by segment. But sometimes it actually happens. So anyway, I thought I'd bring that up because I thought it was an interesting article related to how birds and their slugs or their directional couplers operate and their methodology behind it. That's all. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Quick for Eric, please, Dick. It's one last question before I pass this over to John. I want to go back to you, Eric, and that is, after 9/11, a tremendous amount of extra hardware, antennas, and whatever, had to be put at the mast on the top of the Empire State Building in order to reestablish all those broadcast stations that used to be on World Trade Center to put them back. As such, new feed lines had to be squeezed into the spaces available. And when it comes to compensating devices for all of those extra feed lines and antennas that were added and modified from time to time, my guess is that in theory there had to be quite a bit of tinkering, quite a bit of adjusting in order to make that all fly correctly. Bunch of guesses on my part. You've been there at Empire. Give us a little bit of the inside information as to how difficult it was in the beginning. KE2EJ, K2LIW.
K2RW, K2EJ. Well, Empire is an interesting case because if you remember, before there was the World Trade Center, all the broadcasters were on Empire, so on the mooring mast itself, there was was organized in terms of the FMers, the low band guys, and the high band guys. There was one UHF, because they never bothered to go to World Trade, that was WNYE. But they're currently now on 4 Times Square. So, there was infrastructure to start with. Channel 2 had their satellite. They were the only one on operating in New York City after 9/11, because all they had to do was turn it on. Actually, there's a funny story behind that. Whereas the guy who signed the lease with Empire signed a 99-year lease. They fired the guy, but, you know, after 9/11, they thanked him. That's something that happened, I think, in the early 60s or the mid-60s. I don't remember the exact year that occurred. But, yeah, there was a lot of doing. But after the trade went down, I personally directed putting up a set of antennas that were one of the antenna manufacturers. Let me let it drop. Essentially, at 9/11, a couple of the big antenna manufacturers took all the stuff that they had in their warehouses, loaded it on a truck, and brought it to Alpine, and eventually we got what we needed, and we brought that up to Empire. Actually, I can send you a little video of the actually putting those antennas up to get us back on the air in New York City. The first set was on the 81st floor setback. That's where the 81st floor. They became the standby antennas for many years after that. But the point is that the running mast on Empire already had been slotted out for Channel 2 and 4 for the low bands. And the FMers had a particular position, and NYE had their antenna, which was kind of piggybacked on the side of the mooring mast itself. And then once the digital world came about, was actually Fox or WNEW or WNYW that had an additional UHF put on. The one that belonged to NYE was changed out for a broadband UHF, so most of your use were on that one antenna. Fox is on the other side of the mooring mast. It had Fox and Channel 9 on it, because Murdoch owns that too. And you'll notice that sometimes in some places you have to move your antenna like a fraction of a degree to get one or the other, depending upon where you are, but there's another story behind that. K2RIW, K2EJ.
Channel 2, there's a lot of war stories as to what went on, because all of you guys started off in the dark ages on Empire State Building. And the majority of people moved over to the World Trade Center, and therefore Empire was only partially used for quite a number of years. And all of those empty spaces, I guarantee some of those got refilled, and now you had to juggle everything to put it all back again, is my guess. John, I know you wanted to ask Eric a question. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, thank you, Dick. Eric, if you could, if you still have the copy of that bird memo, could you email it to me, please?
You should send it over to Mike number 2 so that he can put it on his website, technetlimog.com, and it is a very well done article. The combination of the bird article on measuring power and standing wave ratio, and the combination of my article describing quite a bit about how a directional coupler works, some people I think are going to find that valuable. I'm always amazed that, say, for instance, a very nicely constructed NADA directional coupler, blue package, red label, probably cost $3,000 when it was brand new, and may appear at a flea market for $5, $10, and $15, and the majority of amateurs will just pass them by, don't know what they are. And the major reason for rejection is that the frequencies on the label are wrong. Let me drop it. If I wanted a real good directional coupler for 2 meters, 146 megacycles, and if the label on the directional coupler says it works from 500 megs to 1,000, boy, that sounds wrong. where it says it works from 8 to 12 gigahertz. My goodness, does that sound wrong? And after you read that article, you suddenly realize how valuable that thing is at 146 to use a 10 gigahertz directional coupler or a 1 gigahertz directional coupler down at 146 meg or down at 50 megs or down at 30 megs where it is not within the frequency range that's on the label. At first, that sounds crazy. If you read that article, you suddenly realize, wow, I can use any of those at a lower frequency than it's labeled, as long as you know what you're doing. And so this $10 item can become something of $500 of value to you if you know what you're doing when you buy it. So there's a lot more to go there. Okay, we've kept Jim waiting long enough. Jim, VE3, JIW. We'll discuss anything except antennas and transmission lines tonight, Jim. That's a joke. You got it, Jim. K2LIW in the deck net. I'm checking now. I hope we haven't timed out the system. I hope that his connection, which I'm guessing is a EchoLink connection, I hope it's still operational. VE3JIW, K2RIW, go ahead, Jim.
I don't see him on EchoLink.
Was he on EchoLink earlier, Eric? I mean, John?
Dick, I'm not sure. I wasn't monitoring when he came on for that time, but I haven't seen the name there, and I've been watching it for a while, so maybe he wasn't on at all.
Yeah, Eric, what's the easiest way that we can detect when somebody checks in, if he's doing it by IRLP or EchoLink? Is there a characteristic sound, if I was smart enough, I should listen for, that would let me go, let me know that? KE2EJ, K2LIW, he's the guy who set this all up.
Yeah, if you listen to the beeps there, the EchoLink has a little very short higher frequency beep, and the IRLP is more like a bop. Actually, I think the IRLP is like a 600 hertz note, and the EchoLink is like a 900 hertz note. But I'm looking to see who was on, although IRLP won't, actually it will tell me, but I'll tell you in a minute. K2RIW is K2J.
Eric, do you see that note from K2UPS?
Oh, I haven't gotten there yet. Give me a second.
Okay, there might be a problem.
I know that K2UPS on Sunday night quite frequently is traveling somewhere across the United States, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, sometimes Kentucky, and from what I've heard when talking to Dick, whenever possible, he usually listens to the TechNet by his method, which I think is an EchoLink-like method, although is it really? He's starting off with a cell phone system.
Only on EchoLink.
Okay. So, I guess he's given us a message about some particular a characteristic he wants Eric to know about. Over to you, John.
Correct, Dick. He claims it works well for about 20 seconds, then starts giving trouble. So, Eric will take a look at that note. Maybe he can figure out what's going on there.
Yeah, there is a characteristic where occasionally a person coming in through EchoLink sounds beautiful for, let's say, 20 seconds, and all of a sudden it sounds like a single sideband transmission with an AM demodulator. So is that the characteristic we're talking about here or something different? And by the way, when we hear that, it's usually on what I'm going to call the downlink. In other words, we hear that when the distant person is talking to us. I guess I haven't been aware of that happening in the other direction. In other words, does Rich hear a distorted signal occasionally? What do you think, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW.
It's getting fixed, Dick.
this seems to be something new, and it only works in one direction. Also, when you hear that distorted sound on the radio, if I listen to IRLP, the Echolink, it's fine on Echolink. It's only distorted through the system.
Yep. It looks like Eric has it almost pinned down, and he's on the threshold of correcting it. Is that true, Eric?
Now, unfortunately, the computer's on the other side of the room, so the VE station that which you spoke with earlier is not coming into Echolink. It looks like it's coming into IRLPM now. I'm going to take a look into that.
On IRLP.
Okay, is that you, Jim? Are you back?
My node just timed me out. And I definitely IRLP connection BE3JIW.
You're sounding real good, Jim, so go right ahead with your question.
This is a question about a radio that I haven't turned it on yet. It may become mine. It is a JRC, it's Japan Radio Company. And it's a transceiver. Now, I have one of the receivers, but this is a HF only, no 6 meter, 150 watt. And the receiver is a big box like an Icon 71A, and then on the back of it looks like tacked on a box for a transmitter, but it's called a JST-135HP. And I was running, you know, quick consensus of people on frequency. Has anybody played with, used, or owned one of these JRC transceivers, that is transmitter and receiver, and are they still viable?
Yeah, when you say it's viable, I guess you're saying, is the JRC company still there to stand behind the product? And maybe that's not required. That might not be a gating item. That may not be a showstopper, as I see it, Jim. My attitude, every piece of electronics I own is used. Because I don't have a fear of buying used equipment, even if it's dented. You've heard me say that a lot. And depending on the technology of the local ham club you've got and how well those members are equipped with instrumentation, almost anything is fixable. The one exception that we heard from Hal last week is that some of the rigs, like my favorite rig, an oldie but goodie, a Kenwood TS-711A, 2 meter all mode, I was saying that I can fix anything on that, and he said, well, if they dent that that display unit, which has got I think it's plasma sectionalized display unit, that becomes very difficult to fix. But almost everything else, I think, is fixable. Yeah, I guess there is the possibility there's a direct signal, signal generator, which is what I'm looking for, synthesizer, which might have an elaborate integrated circuit that's no longer manufactured. That could be some grief. So, let me drop for a second. I could tell somebody's trying to get through, but I only heard a fraction of a syllable once in a while. So Jim, VE3JIW, is asking us, the JRC radio, a transceiver, 150 watts output, model number JST-135HP. Doesn't sound like a popular rig in our area. So if anybody has any information on that rig, because Jim's on the threshold of buying it, he's going to lay down his valuable cash. He'd like to know if he's got something he's going to have any trouble maintaining. Anybody has any information on that JRC radio, give us your call. Give us your call letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet. America Hotel Kilo. And give me the prefix and your name, sir. And then tell us anything you know about that. That would be helpful. I'm a Hotel Kilo, K2RIW.
Whiskey Bravo 2 Alpha Hotel Kilo. The service manual is available for manuals online. manual man. I have a manual, service manual. I also have a parts rig. If he needs anything, I might even have what he needs. My email me, WB2AHK, WB2 Alpha Hotel Kilo. I might have the parts he needs from my parts rig.
Okay, that was Chester, Alpha Bravo 2, Alpha Hotel Kilo. Hey, Chester, that's a, Chester, that is a fantastic offer. So it looks like somebody's got the service manual, most of the parts. I think we're going to keep you on the air, Jim. So if you acquire that rig, it looks like you've got a contact person now, a set of call letters. Nice thing about ham radio call letters is the guy is always traceable. The FCC knows where you are. So you can always send the guy an email or a snail mail, and in many cases find his phone number. So I wonder if you need a fill on any of that, Jim. BE3JIW. By the way, before I leave you, Chester, what is your experience with that rig? Have you owned one for a month, a year? You got friends that own them? Are they happy with them? Tell us anything about how well it has worked for you, Chester. WB2AHK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Alrighty, WB2AHK. Well, I've had it operating 20, 25 years ago. I used it remotely on a remote site, and it was fine. Forget what happened to it. It might be something with the receiver or something. But I switched to a later model one, the Japan Radio JST-245, and I removed the 135 from my remote base. If he needs anything, he can have the whole rig for parts. I don't remember exactly what's wrong with it, if there is anything wrong with it. And all he has to do is just pay for shipping. I'll ship it to him. You won't have to buy it from me. I'll just give it to him. It's in a pile of stuff that I don't need. Over.
Hey, Chester, you're a good guy. That's one hell of an offer. The price is right. Hey, Jim, looks like you've got a backup system. You're going to have 1 3/4 radios of that model number in your house if you acquire it. BE3JIW. Sure hope you didn't get a dropout and heard all this. K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Jim.
Well, first, I'm going to say, Chester, what an offer. I believe this radio is healthy. It hasn't made, it's only made it near my house. I cleared up my den, so I got where my hydro panel is. I wanted a clear area for hydro to come in. They gave me the blessing. They turned me back on. So I'm no longer a generator, but I can start setting up the radio. I have one of the receivers. It works fine. It's a big radio. And I thought it'd give a nice appearance back door in the matching. They're almost identical fronts. They sneaked in a microphone plug and a level control, but they're very similar, the receiver to the transceiver. Other than the fact it looks nice, Chester's used one. He would say it's a viable radio then. And I'll give it a quick check out this week and have a talk with the gentleman, and if we come to an agreement, that's great. I'm guessing that Chester's experience with the radio says go for it. It's an okay radio. That's what I got, but I would not be unhappy with the radio, and it won't be my only radio, by the way.
So you have a backup of other radios. Chester, you were using the 135 at a remote location, and at a later time you traded it over for the more modern 245. That was just to keep it current. You didn't have any real grief with the 135. Somebody offered you the 245, therefore you used it and substituted for the 135. Is that approximately what happened, Chester? WB2 Alpha Hotel Kilo. And by the way, I'll say Florida Park, New York. I know of Florida, New York. Yes, I've got a relative that lives near Florida, New York. And that's down the road a piece. I wonder how you're getting in here, Chester. WB2AHK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Oh, Dick, that must be a misprint. I'm in Floral Park. by Belmont Racetrack, about 2 or 3 miles south of the Glen Oaks repeater, near Elmont. Now you know where I am. Yeah, the 135 was fine. A lot of power. It was good, but I just modernized my setup. I had a matching linear amplifier for the 245. So, you know, I had to modernize it. I had it running for at least 5 years. It was fine. I had no problems with it. As I said, I got it operating by digital means. I got an interface, and I sent signals on the link, and I was changing frequencies and everything with it. I ran it for at least 5 years. It's fine. It's a reasonably good radio. It's nothing modern, but decent radio. So, you know, it did me well for at least 5 years, so I can't think of anything wrong about it. It's just that the 245 looks so beautiful. It's really modern, multiple colors on the front panel and everything. It was really nice. You know, even the 245 is old and antique now, but when I changed about 15 years ago, at least, I think 15 years ago, to the 245, I was looking at the remote setup, and I said, wow, how nice that looks. That's all it was. You have to modernize every once in a while, I suppose, Dick. Go ahead.
Yes, you do. And I haven't done it. My favorite rigs, like I said, is the Kenwood 711A and Kenwood 811A, the 450 version of it. I think that was a late 80s rig that makes it a healthy 25 years old. But it's got a built-in power supply, the world's best frequency synthesizer. Doesn't have any it's lacking some of the modern-day horns and whistles, but I just love the fact that it's got a knob on the front panel where you can continuously vary the power output of the final stage anywhere from roughly 1 watt to 30 watts. So when you're driving transceivers, that makes it very handy. Sounds like you had a good time with that 135 and 245. And oldies but goodies, there's nothing wrong with that. There's a certain kind of a guy who doesn't want to use a piece of equipment that's more than 2 years old. I think most people trade in their cell phone every 2 years. Let me drop that. And they need all the latest gadgets that are inside, all the latest applications. I guess people will trade in their laptop computer, their palm top computer, their tower base station computer, so to speak. They trade those in every couple of years. And in some cases, you're forced to because the modern-day Microsoft software won't work on the older equipment, so to speak. Okay, if you need any other fills, Jim, looks like you should go through with that deal. And please let us know how it all turns out. And if you have any further questions for Chester as to the idiosyncrasies of that JRC rig, ask him right now. VE3JIW, K2IW in the TechNet. You got it, Jim.
Okay, this is VE3JIW. What luck tonight? Somebody who knows the radio. The receiver I got has both UHF and VHF separate board. They're more boards. They're full little metal packages as tuners. Silence the other receiver, mute the other receiver, and protect its antenna connections. If you look on the internet, out of curiosity, anybody looking, the chassis looks really nicely laid out because it's such a big radio. There appears to be lots of room in it, and nicely mounted boards and rail assemblies. It doesn't look like a jigsaw puzzle. So I'm going to first fire it up and then have a talk with the guy, and probably in a week or two, I'll know where I'm at. I'll say thank you now. And if I do get it, I would find a buddy of mine has the Niagara Falls, New York post office box for receiving stuff, which is an easy way to move stuff. It's not as easy to mail across the border. But Chester, thank you so much. Dick, thank you for squeezing me into your net. And I'll turn it back to Net Control. And thanks from Toronto.
It does look like we made a good connection tonight. And
I'm blind, Chester. It does say Floral Park, and I thought it said Florida Park. I looked at it real close. I'm looking at the QSN.com listing here. And out of curiosity, let's see now. Oh, yes. You're one of those guys that doesn't worry about the knowing what year you were born. There are people who make sure they get that removed. You're not one of those. Well done. Okay. Anyone else with any further questions or comments about all of the above? We've got a couple of minutes left if somebody suddenly checked in late, so to speak, and has a question for us on the quick question section. Give us your call letters right now, then your name, K2RIW in the TechNet.
VDH with a quick comment.
VDH, go right ahead. And, give me the full call.
Oh, yeah, fine business. The call is WA2 Victor David Henry. Yeah, I just wanted to second that recommendation on the JRC equipment. I have the Japan Radio Company NRD-515 and SD-515, and had them for, I'd say at least 15 years now, and they've really been a pleasure. The layout, the internal layout is very well designed. There's lots of room to look at it, to experiment, to open it up, and to move around in it. So I've been very happy with JRC equipment. I know the equipment he's talking about, but the equipment I have is the NRD and NSD-515, the matching transmitter and receiver. Back to net.
Yeah, that was John, WA2VDH. Looks like he's giving it a favorable recommendation, Jim. So it sounds like you should go forward, as long as it's not $1 zillion. And if it looks so good, who cares what year it was made? If it performs well and looks good and it's a little bit bulky, if you got the room for it, go for it. Some of these super modern pieces of equipment, where they squeeze things as tight as they possibly can. You take the latest, greatest of these cell phones, the ones that just came out, which, yes, they've got a larger screen, but they work super hard as to making it as thin as absolutely possible, which means they've skimped on the antenna, they've skimped on the battery. And when people put it in their back pocket and sit down, it ends up bending. So I would much rather buy a piece of electronics that has the size of screen on it that I like as a cell phone, and I'd like a little bit of extra thickness to it. And the exact weight doesn't matter to me. The extra thickness gives you more battery, more life, and more stiffness, so it can tolerate being in a pocket without bending. So I think they pushed it a little bit too far. That's a bunch of opinions. And with any further questions or comments on all of the above, give me a call. Letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WS2N.
You're sounding good, Paul. Go right ahead.
Yeah, this has to do with that broadcast TV. And I was wondering if this happened to you, maybe Eric. We have a digital receiving box, and you know, you've got some 30 different channels. And in my case, channel 13 has like 13-1, 13-2, 13-3. The other day, they swapped. One swaps with, I think, number 3. So, if you bring up the guide, you know, you're looking at the guide, and it tells you it's some Spanish show. Meanwhile, it's the show you normally watch. You know, in my case, I was going to record a good show about Benjamin Franklin looking at the first balloons back in the 1700s go up in France. I was setting the recorder. I said, look at this. Everything got backwards. I wonder, you know, it's very odd that, I mean, everything works fine, but it's backwards now. You know, and then you go through here to what you think is the normal channel 13 and the Spanish show, you know, the Spanish 13. I don't know how that could possibly happen. It's an RCA box. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to pass it over to Eric in a few minutes to give us his comment on that. You've got an RCA set-top box that converts your digital signal to an analog, and then you plug it into your NTSC-type television. Mine is a Radio Shack, and mine does that period.